This is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Samite Mulondo is an internationally acclaimed musician and humanitarian. He's a native of Uganda and the star of a biographical one-man play called Resilience. Earlier this year, he premiered his one-man play at the University of St. Joseph's Otorino Center in West Hartford, Connecticut. Samite joins me now in studio. Samite, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
I understand that you've been playing the flute for many years. What brought you to that instrument?
Well, my grandfather used to play the wooden flute, and so did my uncle. So from a very early age, I wanted to be just like them.
And did they teach you?
My uncle did first, and then my grandfather took it on. And then later on, I was introduced to the silver flute when I went to high school.
How old were you when you picked up the wooden flute?
I think I started trying to play it when I was about 6. And then later on, when I was 12, that's when I picked up the silver flute. And I loved the sound of the birds, so it was just one way to copy the birds.
That's interesting. I was listening to a talk that you did, a TED Talk, a few years ago, and you were talking a lot about your grandfather's influence on your life. So he was the one that helped introduce you to the wooden flute, but mm-hmm. he also talked about the importance of the nature around you. Can you tell us about some of the stories he told you?
What he really wanted me to always remember that material things were meaningless. He wanted me to be more aware of the beauty of the nature around me, the birds. He would make me clean, even this, you know, where the leaves are falling, would clean those so that I was paying attention to what was around me. So I think it's just the respect for nature and the trees and things mm-hmm. like that. And he'd also show me how to, you know, to work with monkeys when they would come to eat my grandmother's sweet potatoes.
Mm. What were the first songs that you played as a child?
I think I just remember sounds like pa-da-pa-pa, pa-da-pa, pa-da-pa-pa, pa-da-pa, pa-da-pa-pa, pa-da-pa. And something about dodo, which is green. It's like spinach. So like they're trying to convince us to eat spinach. So they make, you know, we hated it. So it's like you sing it in a song and it becomes something that you eat to become strong.
Well, I don't want to tease our listeners without hearing you play. Do you mind playing a little from your flute?
Definitely. I would love to do that.
Manyoli mubaka wa mutonzi.
That's Sammy Tay, a world-renowned musician originally from Uganda, in our studio today here on Where We Live as we learn more about his life. Sammy Tay, tell our listeners who are hearing you but they can't see you exactly how you were able. Mm-hmm. We could hear you playing the flute, mm-hmm. and then we could hear you're using a looper pedal.
Yes.
So describe how you're making that sound.
So basically, I record myself many times over, which is just really a beautiful thing because you can practice as many times as you want until morning without having to ask musicians to stay up the whole night. So the looper, I love the looper because it gives me an opportunity to have many samites singing. And so just layering layers and layers, of my voice on this machine.
And describe your flute. It appears longer than a flute that when I was back in band years ago playing the saxophone.
Yeah.
The flutes that I would see in my orchestra look different than the one you're playing.
This is a big alto flute, and usually people use the little U to make it shorter, but I prefer to have it really long. Yeah.
Tell us about the song that you were singing. What were you saying?
The song is actually on my new CD coming out in June. It's called Resilience. The CD is called Resilience. The song is called Resilience. And the play is called Resilience. So I'm singing in a language called Luganda. And I'm saying that whenever you are afraid, remember that you are a messenger from the Creator. You know, when things go down, you're scared. Well, how am I going to accomplish this? I think if you're confident, you realize that there's a reason why you're here. There's a purpose, even though nobody knows what our purpose is.
I wanted to learn more about your life in Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your childhood and about the country that you remember.
The country, I remember the two parts of it. The first part of it was beautiful. The sound of birds, you know, the sound of monkeys coming in from the forest, sharing, where you could go to any neighbor's house and you eat food, where the neighbor is free to discipline you with a cane if you misbehaved, where you could just go pick up mangoes, sugarcane, guavas, anything, go just, you know, explore in the forest. That was the first part of my growing up. And then the second part of it is when Idi Amin came to power, and all of a sudden it was sounds of guns, explosions, people disappearing, and the birds stopped singing. So that's another part of Uganda. And then obviously seeing bodies on the streets and losing family members, and that's the other part of Uganda that I grew up in, yeah.
Let's back up. How old were you when Idi Amin staged a coup and took power?
I was around, when he came to power, I think I was somewhere around 12. Mm-hmm. And that was a scary time.
And what do you remember? You said that, obviously, he was known as the butcher of Uganda. Mm-hmm. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed under his regime. But as a child, what do you remember, besides not hearing nature anymore?
That's the first time I lost somebody that I knew. There was a young man that I used to stay with in my room, and he didn't come back. You know, I used to sneak him in. He used to go dancing and come back in. And all of a sudden, they told us he's not coming back. And then the next day, they told us he's really not coming back. He died. And for me, that was so scary because I was looking forward to telling him stories, things that, you know, I'd seen that day, and it said, no, he died. He was shot in the face. That was the first death that I really experienced. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that later on you had family members who died.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about the people you lost?
I lost my stepdad. He was a doctor, Dr. Paul Wamala. later on, you know, Idi Amin basically started the culture of killing. So later on, I lost my brother, Richard. But at that time, we had a different dictator, Milton Obote. He'd come back. And then many others, but those were the two big ones, Richard Mulondo and my stepdad, Paul Amala.
When did you decide that it was time for you to flee?
That was 1982. That's when I decided it was not safe for me to stay. And my family also agreed it wasn't safe for me to stay. Because I used to really hang out with Richard, and when Richard was kidnapped, then we didn't know who else they were coming for.
How did you make that decision? Because, again, this is the world you knew, the country of your birth, mm-hmm. and it's not easy to have to leave, but at the same time, you were fearful. Tell us about that breaking point for you.
The breaking point is actually an interesting one, because we were in a band at that time. A friend of mine and I had created a cover band, and I was Rod Stewart, and my friend was playing, you know, Marvin Gaye, and we had a Bob Marley, and we were like really popular, like playing in a disco and big concerts, and like people knew who we were. And then one day I was having my shoes polished on the street, and I saw two policemen walking behind me, and they came, and the way they looked at me, it looked like they were really going to kidnap me. And I was actually planning, maybe I should kill them instead of me being tortured like my brother. I was actually really planning on how I was going to do it. And at that point, one of them just asked me, when am I going to perform again? When are you guys performing again? We managed traffic. Last time you guys performed, the band was called the Mixed Talents. When are you performing again? For me, that was the breaking point. I was like, oh my goodness, I was just really planning to kill. I was just about to join in the culture of killing. And that's when I decided that's not for me, and I needed to leave.
Where did you decide to go?
I went to Kenya, which is right next door. And I had to leave everything behind, because at that time, the way you had to escape, you had to pretend you're not really leaving, you're coming back, like you're going for a little bit. If they knew you're leaving for good, they would just take you in and nobody would see you again. So I went to Nairobi first and then ended up in a refugee camp there, called Thika Refugee Camp.
What was that like to be in a refugee camp? I mean, today there's so much focus on the refugee camps where Syrians have fled because of civil war. Mm-hmm. What was it like to be in Kenya at this particular camp at this particular time?
Mm-hmm. It was eye-opening for me in a good way. It's what created who I am right now. It showed me that we're all human beings, poor, rich, educated, uneducated, street beggars were there. And in the refugee camp, we were all just refugees trying to survive. Because there was always fear that somebody could be poisoned in the camp. So there was like watching out for your friends. You cooked for, we divided ourselves in groups of seven. So, you know, we took turns to cook. And no one would take a bite until the cook took the first bite. That was just something that I had never experienced. But what I say it was an eye-opener for me was it just made me realize that I could spend my life thinking about other people also, not just about myself. That's what changed my life. And the kind of lifestyle I was brought up in, we were like well-to-do people. So you had people doing things for you. And all of a sudden I realized those people that who were working for me, they were also... They're kind people. They're people who have joy. They have sadness. They're not people you just say, hey, bring me this, bring me that. And that only happened when I was in the refugee camp. In fact, when I go back to Uganda now to visit, I see some of my relatives who they still think they're better than everybody else because they have more money. They have more education. They don't know if you strip that all away, we're just all human beings. I think the only person who knew that already in my life was my grandfather.
When you fled Uganda, you mm-hmm. said that you couldn't make plans because you didn't want people to find out mm-hmm. where you were going. Mm-hmm. So were you even able, you weren't able to say goodbye to any of your family?
I didn't say goodbye to a lot of family members. My dad knew I was leaving, and so did my mother. The rest of the other people, you know, they just found out I had left. Because if the word leaked out, then you could really get in trouble. Yes.
How long did you foresee yourself living there?
This is weird. You know, I only lived there for about 4 months. But when it got time for me to leave, I didn't want to leave. I was used to that life. I'd built a little community there myself. There were some rebels there pretending to be refugees. And I used to train them in Taekwondo. And they were actually part of the group of seven that I used to work with. And then many other people joined us. So just built a little bit of a reputation there and a following. But there was also sadness. There was no music in that place. There was not a single day that they brought music. We only watched one TV show called Dallas.
I remember Dallas.
You remember Dallas? We didn't call it Dallas. We called it JR. So
yeah. Premise is, who killed JR?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, again, this was a difficult time, right? You said that after you got acclimated, you weren't sure, you didn't want to leave, mm-hmm. but you actually met your first wife.
After I left, yes.
So tell us how you left before you met your first wife.
So you do these interviews. They're done by the UN and also the Kenyan government. And you said, you know, these guys are behind the desk and they ask you, why did you leave? And you tell them the whole thing. And then they say, okay, you're free to go. They give you a passport, UN passport, and you become, you know, somebody who's allowed to even travel, but especially work in Nairobi. And then you have to look for a job. They give you a little bit of money, but it's totally useless. So I found a job as a, you know, in a band called the African Heritage Band. And that's when I met Joanne. I met her in Nairobi. And it was a time when I didn't, you know, I hadn't recorded anything. And she had my music and she encouraged me to record it and to practice my music and everything. And then she helped me sell my first cassettes. It was very difficult for me to sell them because at that point, the business people, they were Asians, Indians from Asia. And they would not allow the African to come and sell cassettes or anything. They would tell you, go away. And Joanne was an American woman. And so when they kicked me out of the stores, she brought the same basket back and they bought everything. And from there on, she sold to all the Indians in Nairobi. So she became kind of my manager. And then we fell in love. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you faced discrimination in
Africa.
Kenya. Yeah.
Yes, definitely. Which is kind of very disappointing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is Where We Live. I'm speaking with Ugandan musician and storyteller Sami Tay, whose one-man play, Resilience, premiered at University of St. Joseph in March. So you fell in love with Joanne, mm-hmm. and then what?
Then we didn't really feel safe in Nairobi. There were so many, you know, foreign government spies there. So we made plans to move to the U.S., I ended up a little bit in New York City, and I didn't feel so safe in New York the first 4 months. It was the first time I realized you can't really lean on a car without people think you're going to break in. Because in Africa, everybody's black. We're the majority everywhere. So all of a sudden, leaning on somebody's car, you could be a thief. Somebody might think you're going to break in. So those were all new things for me to deal with. So I moved to Ithaca, New York. So
that's a culture shock.
That was a little bit of a culture shock, especially, first of all, it was very cold. And secondly, I had to pretend I was a vegetarian to make friends. And so that was another thing, you know, and learn what you do before you go to visit these people. You eat, you know, a chunk of beef, and then you go. And then you start talking about how much you love sprouts and tofu. And so that was a transitional thing. And then later on, you know, I just became a native of Ithaca, yeah. Yeah.
So you were able to come to the U.S. Your status was as a refugee, but your wife, Joanne, was American?
She was American. I came as a visiting refugee. So I was a visitor, really. I didn't come as a refugee. And I just started applying, and we were not married at first. We got married in Ithaca.
And then your musical career took off. Tell us about that.
I was one of those people that I say I was in the right place at the right time. Early on, somebody came and heard my music in Ithaca, you know, saw me doing, I was doing solo performances. And this guy heard me, and this guy asked me, what are you going to do here? I heard you in Africa when you're performing. I heard you in Kenya. And he introduced me to a guy who owned a studio so that I could learn recording. I didn't have real money to pay for the recording, but the engineer said, if you play some of your music, my students could learn on, you know, be the guinea pig. And when that was happening, he said, wow, we could record this stuff. And I said, I can't afford to pay for it. And he said, no, the guy who introduced you to me is a millionaire. He can pay for it. So we recorded an album. And this same guy who paid for it said, I have a friend in New York City. I'll send it to him. And that friend happened to be the general manager for Ladysmith Black Mambazo. And the following week, I was in New York City meeting Paul Simon. And then a month after that, I was on tour with Ladysmith Black Mambazo.
This was a time when African music was becoming more popular in the U.S. thanks to Paul Simon.
Yeah, Paul Simon had made it really popular at that time. Like, we were well received almost everywhere we went, yes.
So from Paul Simon and Ladysmith Black Mambazo, you also performed for the Dalai Lama.
Yes. That was...
How did that come about?
He came to visit Ithaca. And it was very interesting, like, you know, I had never met him, and people were very, very, very excited, and people were crying backstage, and I was asking them, why are you crying, you know? He's just another guy, and then after I finished performing for him, I had a choir behind me, and when I finished performing, he was bowing and thanking me. I started crying like everybody else. And I was like, I didn't know. I cried for a few days. It felt somehow he had some amazingly positive energy that just overwhelmed me. And I felt good for a few days. So that's how that came about. And then later on, I was invited to perform in Canada at the Dalai Lama Center there.
So your musical career really took off. Did you ever think that that was the path that you would take after coming here? Or was it, did you feel like you were just in the right place at the right time?
Well, Joanne had told me I'd be able to perform in New York. That's actually before I realized it was Ithaca, New York. And so in my mind, I knew I'd play in New York. But I didn't know it was going to end up the way it went until I met another musician called Pete Seeger. And Pete told me, Samite, your music needs to be brought into places where people can't even afford to pay. And that changed the direction of where my music went. I fired my management, started bringing my music into some of the refugee camps and places like that.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I'm speaking with internationally known musician and humanitarian Samite Mulondo. His one-man play, Resilience, premiered earlier this year at the University of St. Joseph's Ottarino Center in West Hartford, Connecticut. When we come back, we find out more about his transition to using his music to help others. And we'll hear more of Samite perform. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're joined in studio by Samite Mulondo. He's an internationally acclaimed musician and humanitarian and the star of a biographical one-man play called Resilience, which premiered earlier this year at the University of St. Joseph's Ottarino Center in West Hartford. Samite once lived in a refugee camp after fleeing Uganda. He would later move to the U.S. and settle in Ithaca, New York, where he married his wife, Joanne. Earlier we heard you play the flute. You also play other instruments. Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the ones that you brought here today with you.
I brought so many instruments. I brought a kalimba.
That's like the thumb piano?
The thumb piano, yes. But I also brought an instrument called litungu. It's a harp. That's one of my favorite instruments. That one I was given when I was in Nairobi, when I left the refugee camp. I saw this old guy walking on the street, and he was holding one of those. He became my friend, and he brought me that particular instrument that I play now around the world. It's a harp with 7 strings. They're fishing lines. The instrument is made out of goat skin. Yeah.
Can we hear you play the litungu? Thank you. Again, that's Sami Tay here on Where We Live. I did want to ask you if you could tell us about the song that you played on the harp.
The song I played on the harp is a song that I used to heal my, you know, when I was in Kenya, when I was after I left the refugee camp, and I met this old guy who gave me that instrument. I wrote that song called Waterfall. Mm. It's a song that was just for me, was to heal me. When I was missing Uganda, when I was missing the rivers, the lakes, the mountain, Uganda is like full of hills, full of rivers, full of little forests, and it's just a beautiful country. So the only way I used to go back there when I was a refugee was through this song, Waterfall. It's still, to me, it's one of the most healing songs because it heals me.
You were telling us before that song that you wanted to bring your music to people who may not have the resources.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about that journey, why you made that switch in your career.
It's a long story, but one time I was doing a concert upstate New York, and this very tall guy came up to me, and he said, "Hey, Samite, my music is something that our kids grew up on. Would you also be interested in maybe we take that music back to Africa and maybe you go do some humanitarian work with me back in Africa?" So this guy just encouraged me to go back to Africa. But it was at the time when it was so scary to go back. There was ethnic cleansing going on in Rwanda, massacres in Liberia. And it was at a time when I really didn't want to go back. But I just said yes to him right away because I felt like he looked like he couldn't really put together a trip the way he was dressed. And I thought he was one of those people who just talk. And but then he convinced PBS to air the documentary we were going to shoot there. So I found myself on a plane going back to Africa and going to Liberia. And once we landed there, we headed towards an IDP camp, internally displaced persons camp. And there the children looked so lost and so sad. They had seen so much suffering and death that they had become numb. Flies were flying in and around their eyes and they didn't even, care. And I found out that by playing the wooden flute, these kids started pulling on my shirts, say, "Hey, I have a song. Can I sing for you too?" And it was just amazing. It was magical. And then the mothers would hear the children sing for the first time, and the mothers would come in and start taking over the whole show with their own music. Even the men would come and join in slowly. And this happened every camp we went to, wherever we visited. And that's when I realized there's something about the healing power of music. There's a reason why I'm a musician. There's a reason why Pete Seeger was telling me I need to bring my music to people who can't afford to pay. And that changed my whole life.
You saw how therapeutic it was for these children.
Yes.
And their parents to mm-hmm. hear your music in the refugee camps. What was the impact on you?
Well, here's the thing. It wasn't even about my music. it just helped them to sing again. It wasn't even like, I'm going to continue performing for you. In fact, the women would, in all, some of these places, they just say, you sit down. We're going to sing for you. So they would sing for me. And then they would tell me their stories. And the thing is, their stories are so painful, some of them. I had to learn to strengthen myself. I had to learn to heal myself from the horrible stories they would share. But the thing that was, which is still, you know, something that drives me, which actually even drives the new CD that I do, is they would, after that, all that singing, they start talking about the future. Even the kids, even the former child soldiers, the kids who'd been meant to kill, after the music, they start talking about when things get better. When things get better, this is what I'm going to do. When I make new friends, like little kids say, I'm going to make new friends. What happened to your other friends? They died. But I'm going to make new friends. So I realized that music makes them stronger, brings out the resilience. And, you know, we are very strong. Human beings are very strong. A little bit of song could make you go back to realizing this is not the end. Things are going to get better.
From Liberia, did you contemplate going back to Uganda?
Oh, we did go back to Uganda.
What was that like?
That was that was something else. My dad had never heard me play before. He used to hate me being a musician. He was embarrassed that I was playing flute. The music doesn't come from that side of the family. My music comes from my mother's side of the family. My dad was, all my brothers, they're all accountants. Everything has to do with accounting, you know, and money. So when I went back, it was the anniversary for my brother Richard, who was killed. And, you know, it was amazing timing. And my dad asked me if I could speak in memory of my brother. And I said, actually, I'd like to play something for him on the flute. So I played the flute, and my father cried. So that was, like, amazing for me. It was the most, it's amazing how much, I used to think I didn't care what he thought, but when he cried, and then from there on he said, did you bring it? Whenever I went to visit after that, he would ask me to bring the flute, and I did each time to play for him.
Did you feel that your father was finally proud of you?
He said, I knew it. I knew this guy. He took credit. But he had to ask me, so did these white people follow you all over wherever you went? I said, yes. They followed you even like every country you've been visiting? I said, yes. Then he started saying, I knew it. I knew you were talented. He took credit, actually. But that was okay for me, as long as he didn't feel embarrassed anymore.
You were talking, Samite, about the reaction that these children and adults had when they heard you play. Mm. It gave them hope. They started talking about the future. When we think about refugee camps today, it's easy to think about the bare necessities. Mm. These people need food and clothing, a roof over their head. But this idea of also needing something more to give them mm-hmm. meaning back in their lives.
Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. Everybody, you know, the UN, church organizations, all provide them with food, shelter, and some education. But sometimes they forget to heal the soul. And music heals the soul. And actually, that's when I started an organization called Musicians for World Harmony, to try to bring music to distressed people. And this is what we do with this organization. We just help people sing again.
Have you seen a change from agencies like the UN where they realize that this kind of programming can help these people who've been traumatized?
Yes, they actually do. I mean, like some of the places I go are so dangerous. Like I've gone to like Bukavu in Congo, and UNICEF was doing this transportation, and they would call to see if it was safe to go there. And they saw... you know, the people who are down on the ground see the difference. They see the child soldier who's been so traumatized, he's so scared, and all of a sudden he's singing, like we leave a musical instrument behind, and he's playing, you know, holding a guitar. And he's so proud because he's no longer embarrassed. He's now somebody who's bringing something joyful. Yeah, they definitely have to see this, and I've seen it myself. You see immediate change in their eyes, in the way they walk. I do these programs where I call them Music Heals program, where I record them singing their songs or telling their stories to music. And the change in the way they walk, when you play back the music in a boombox, they feel like they're kings again. It's just like a big, it's an amazing way of starting the healing process.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're talking with musician and humanitarian Samite Mulondo. His one-man play, Resilience, premiered earlier this year at the University of St. Joseph in West Hartford. After the break, Samite talks about his views on the rhetoric surrounding refugees in the U.S., and we'll learn more about his one-man play, Resilience. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Samite is an acclaimed musician and humanitarian, and the star of a biographical one-man play called Resilience. He lived in a refugee camp in Kenya before moving to the U.S., where his professional career took off. How long have you lived in the U.S. now?
Since 1987. That's a long time.
In the last few years, the discourse around refugees at times can be xenophobic, where we focus on differences and we worry about the safety of allowing people from certain countries to come and live in the U.S. What's your reaction as someone who has walked that same path?
It's very heartbreaking. I do work with Somali kids in Syracuse area, kids who've escaped some of the worst, bad situations. And their dream was to go to a place like when I came to this beautiful place where you're allowed to say, to pray wherever, whenever you want to pray. You're allowed to do anything you want to do. And all of a sudden, these young girls are afraid to walk on the streets because people are judging them because of the way they are dressed. They're afraid that their religion is conceived to be a dangerous religion when they're like, no, this is not. So it's really heartbreaking, but I feel like the part I play is to bring music to them and let them tell their story through music. And I've seen amazing changes in their attitude, in the way they become stronger.
Another subject that causes division in our country today is race. Mm-hmm. You talked about moving to the U.S., to Ithaca as an African. I'm just curious, through the many years you've lived here now, how do you talk about where you come from to people who may not know anything about Uganda or who might see you and have preconceived notions about you because of the color of your skin?
Mm-hmm. I have the fact that I have the weapon of music. It's easier for me to talk about Africa, to talk about Uganda, the beautiful Uganda before the dictators, because music kind of breaks the ice. When I'm on stage, sometimes 3,000-4,000 people dancing, they don't care where I'm from. They're just in the magic. The music in that moment takes them to a place that opens up all their, whatever bad things they had in their heads, throws those out, and they realize we are all human beings enjoying. And I think, for me, it's easier then to talk about Uganda as a beautiful country. I don't think everyone else, other Africans who are not doing music would find it as easy as I have to break that ice and talk about the beautiful Africa. But I also, because of my traveling and going to many different places, like right now I live in a place, really very conservative place in upstate New York. I find that if I just open up and talk to people and not talk politics, I can talk to anybody. And it's amazing when they realize we have a lot in common, when they realize the stories I talk about. When I talk about the TV shows I used to watch, I talk about Dallas, I talk about all these different things. I talk about the cars, and it's amazing how some people don't even know their cars in Africa. I do these school performances, and kids ask me, did you live in trees before you came here? And the kids who ask those questions are usually my own, you know, they are usually black kids. Because they've been made to think Africa is all bad. And their parents haven't read National Geographic books to them to, even if they read actually National Geographic, they only see animals mostly. That would be most sorry to say. But but still, they have seen nothing positive about Africa. So they ask me, so did you live in trees before you came here? I don't even get mad because they don't know. I take it as an opportunity to say, hey, what? Guess what? Where I grew up, we had better houses than you guys have here. We have beautiful double-story houses and beautiful TVs, beautiful cars, beautiful people travel there. Like, in Africa? Yeah. People, you know, they get surprised. But I also tell them, though, in the villages, people still live in mud houses with thatched grass, but they're happy people. So I try to give them the true picture. Yeah.
So your music allows you also to be an educator.
I am an educator. I spend a lot of time in schools educating kids and showing them, you know, getting them to sing African songs, getting them to ask questions. Yes.
We're talking with you today, Sami Tay, because of the world premiere of your one-man play, Resilience. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about resilience. So we learned a little bit about your life, about some of the challenges, the journeys that you've taken. How do you tell your story in this play as a musician?
I used to perform a little bit, like say little stories in my performances, meaning like I would say, oh, this song is about this. And then I ended up doing a TED Talk. And then a professor from the University of St. Joseph, a director actually of the theater department, Steve Ginsberg, came to one of the TED Talks I was doing. And he invited me to come to this area to help me turn my story into a one-man theater performance. And that ended bringing me to be a better performer, a storyteller at a different level to where, when I tell this story, I actually relive the moment of that I'm telling the person about. Instead of just saying, oh, we got shot there, I actually take you through what we felt like. What we felt like when we were being shot at. What we felt like when that was happening. So as a musician telling the story, the music just accompanies the story. It's really the spoken word that goes on. So.
Is it difficult to recount some of these personal experiences? Because this is your story that you're on stage telling a room full of strangers.
It was difficult at first, but now it's becoming, because of the training I've had. I've been here over like 20 months. The training that I've had from the college here, you know, University of St. Joseph, has made it possible for me to relive the moment. I do get in a sad place each time I tell it. Sometimes I actually cry in the training when we are rehearsing because I'm reliving the moment. But that makes it possible for the audience to actually also feel like they're right there.
I understand that you lost your first wife, Joanne, to cancer. That's part of this play as well?
It's part of the play. And that was actually one of the toughest ones to bring back, because when you lose somebody and then you get remarried, you've moved on, kind of. It doesn't mean you've forgotten the other person, but in the play, I bring her back to life. I bring her back to life. So that one was one of the toughest ones.
What's the message of your play? Beyond, if we look at the title, Resilience, we can draw meaning from that. But what do you want people to think about when they're sitting in front of you hearing your story?
I want them to realize that even when you're going through the toughest and the toughest situation, you have to realize that with time, things get better. You have to realize that you are stronger than what you think you are, and that you are built to deal with a lot of pain, and that you'll smile again, you will sing again. I think if we remember that happiness will come back again, I think we'll be stronger people. I think we'll realize we'll be able to be that happy person again.
We mentioned earlier, Samite, that your 11th CD, Resilience, will be coming out later this summer. We're wondering if you could perform for us one last time.
I totally can. But the tune I'm going to play for you is going to be actually on a kalimba. It's not on the new CD. The song Resilience I played is on the new CD. But this one is going to be something that I just came to play for you.
That's Samite, a Uganda native who is an internationally acclaimed musician and humanitarian. He's the star of a biographical one-man play, Resilience. More information on our website, WMPR.org. Samite, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me and allowing me to share.
For videos of Samite performing in studio, check out our Facebook page at Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. Special thanks to Steve Ginsburg, Gina Matruda, Lydia Brown, Carlos Mejia, and Ryan Karen King.